is number 13-1199, Pacific Coast Marine versus Malibu Boats.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Mr. Rode, is that the way you pronounce it?
It's Rode, Your Honor.
Rode. Okay.
Robert Rode for Pacific Coast Marine Windshield. We raised four issues in our briefing on which we feel that the district court committed error in rendering its summary judgment opinion. The first of those involves the application of prosecution history estoppel to restrict the scope of colorable imitations under 35 U.S.C. Section 289. In the Festo decision, the Supreme Court tells us that prosecution history estoppel is a judicial doctrine that assures that the doctrine of equivalence remains tied to its essential purpose, and that essential purpose has to do with the inability of language to capture an invention in a utility patent. With respect to a design patent, which is what it's at issue here, we don't have the judicial doctrine of the doctrine of equivalence. We're talking about colorable imitations under Section 289, the statute, and moreover, as design patents are obviously claimed in terms of photographs or drawings, the limitations of language aren't relevant.
Is it your understanding that the articulation in Section 289 is on all fours with the Gorham case articulation?
I think that, yes, I think that Congress codified the Gorham Ordinary Observer Test when it passed the Patent Act of 1887, and I think it incorporated that same test when it passed.
Substantially similar or something like that is the Gorham test, right?
Gorham talks about substantially similar, but yes, I think that was the test that was before Congress when it passed 289, yes, and I think that colorable imitation is intended to capture the Ordinary Observer Test.
Is there a separate doctrine of equivalence for design patent infringement, given that literal infringement of design patents includes some sort of element of equivalency?
Well, there's certainly a similarity between equivalence and the doctrine of equivalence and determining whether there is a colorable imitation of a design patent.
Let me ask my question a little differently. When it comes to means plus function limitations and literal infringement of a means plus function limitation in the utility patent context, you look to see whether the accused device is either the same structure as the structure disclosed in the patent specification or some structural equivalent of that. And then if there isn't, then there's no literal infringement. However, you can still make a claim for infringement under the doctrine of equivalence for a means plus function limitation. So it seems like there's two tiers of equivalency being considered in that context. And I'm just trying to figure out, for design patent infringement, is there anything like that as well? Is there, in fact, a doctrine of equivalence that still stands in the design patent infringement context, given the Gorham test seems to suggest there's notions of equivalency involved when determining literal infringement of a design patent?
No, I don't think there is a literal infringement determination under Gorham and then a separate doctrine of equivalence determination in addition to that, and I think this court has indicated that in the Lee case. I think what we have is one test, and the test is the ordinary observer test that's set forth in Gorham as modified by Egyptian Goddess, and I think that's the test in each and every case when we're looking at infringement under a design patent.
But if in a design patent context there were two drawings in the original patent application, and the examiner brought up prior art with respect to one of the drawings and said, this is just like the prior art. I think this is obvious over the prior art. And the result is that the applicant withdraws that drawing, cancels that part of the claim. Why should it be that in a subsequent infringement litigation that the patentee can say, well, sure, I gave it up in the prosecution to get my patent, but I can still assert it as being within the colorable standard? Why should that be allowed?
We're not arguing that it should be allowed. It's our position that after this court's Egyptian goddess case, the prior art is part of the infringement analysis.
So, well, that's a different question. What I'm saying is, why shouldn't the patentee be stopped from claiming the very design that it gave up in the course of the prosecution?
Well, I don't think the patentee can. I think if it gave it up because that design is part of the prior art, then I think the patentee would not be able to claim that that design is infringing. I think Egyptian goddess would preclude that.
Okay, so to some extent, we have an estoppel here.
Well, I wouldn't call it an estoppel. I would simply point out, I would say that unlike utility patents where that could be possible, I don't think it does apply in the instance of design patents, and therefore there is not a compelling reason to apply this doctrine in the instance of design patents.
Maybe that would be prosecution disclaimer. If you give up, say, one of the two drawings in your design patent application in view of a prior art rejection. And it's not necessarily a 102, which is, I think, what you're thinking. Oh, it's part of the prior art. Well, maybe it's an obvious variation of the prior art. It's a 103 rejection. And then you just straight up cancel that figure, then you wouldn't be able to argue that the scope of your still live figure in your design patent is so broad that it covers the very figure that you canceled in light of that prior art rejection.
Well,
because you'd have to construe the claim in light of the prosecution history, and then you gave up that embodiment during the prosecution.
If the tenets of prosecution disclaimer were satisfied, I'm not arguing that prosecution disclaimer doesn't apply in design patents. And yes, I think your question assumed that the tenets of prosecution disclaimer were satisfied. And yes, you wouldn't be able to claim that. In our case, the argument was made under a prosecution disclaimer argument, and the district court rejected during claim construction that the scope of the 070 patent was restricted.
Why should there be a difference in terms of design patents between prosecution disclaimer and prosecution history estoppel? If we have prosecution disclaimer, why don't we have prosecution history estoppel also?
Well, I think prosecution disclaimer goes to the meaning of the claims and how the court construes them, and I think there's a different burden of proof involved. But I don't think that comes to bear in the instance of prosecution history estoppel. I don't think there's a compelling reason. Our position is that there's not a compelling reason to apply the estoppel argument, since in most instances we're looking at, in utility patents, claim scope that was...
Well, I'm not sure if compelling reason is the right test. I mean, we have the Festo case, we have all these other cases, and the question is, why should we treat design patents differently than utility patents with respect to this doctrine, which is so well established in the utility context?
And the reason is because the ordinary observer test applies at all infringement analyses. So we're not simply talking about applying an estoppel in a doctrine of equivalence analysis. You're talking about applying an estoppel in every single infringement analysis. Because the defendant's position is that anytime there's an amendment, it gives rise to an estoppel. So whenever we have an amendment in an application for a design patent, we would be raising an estoppel issue with respect to the infringement analysis. Congress codified the ordinary observer test when it passed Section 289, and our position is that there's not a sufficient reason to adopt the prosecution history estoppel doctrine in this context to bring about what would be a sweeping change.
Let's get back to the facts of your case. You have a restriction requirement in the prosecution, right?
Yes.
And in response to that, you canceled the two-hole embodiment, right?
We made an election, yes.
Right. You elected the four-hole embodiment.
Yes.
And you never pursued the two-hole embodiment in division.
That's correct.
So would you agree that your four-hole embodiment design patent doesn't cover that two-hole embodiment?
No, right? We wouldn't agree with that at all. This court's decision in the Merck versus Mylan Pharmaceutical case says that we must look carefully at the reason for the amendment. And in this case, there's no evidence that the election was made for issues of patentability. In this case, we had the applicant submitted drawings, figures 1 through 12.
Well, you maybe rely on Merck, but the Supreme Court in Festo described it more broadly, right?
I think the Supreme Court in Festo indicated that the court should also look to determine what the reason for the...
Well, they said if you made the amendment to get the patent.
I think the court said for issues of patentability. Yes, I think the issue is what is the under is if there's an underlying issue of patentability of the subject matter. I don't interpret Festo as saying that procedural issues. Defendant's argument is that because the patent wouldn't issue unless the election was made, then it was for issues of patentability. I think if we look at the underlying application file, there was no citation of 102 or 103 or section 112. There's no prior art on which one could make a prima facie case of anticipation or obvious.
I think we're talking about a couple different concepts that are related but still different. One is prosecution history estoppel. And as far as I know, prosecution history estoppel, this court has never applied that to a restriction. But then there are notions of prosecution disclaimer. Or, for example, there's a doctrine of some form of estoppel where a patent owner on reissue is not permitted to recapture non-elected claims and thereby expand the scope of his patent. And so that's what I'm trying to understand here when I ask you the question, is your two-hole embodiment that you didn't elect to pursue basically off the table now in terms of understanding the scope of your four-hole embodiment?
Well, if we're simply claiming that we're entitled to the full scope of colorable imitations provided by Section 289. So if the two-hole embodiment was a colorable imitation of the patent that issued the 070, then we would maintain, yes, it's not off the table. Because it was not surrendered for reasons related to patentability. There was never a question about the patentability of that. Mr. Bach was simply required to choose to elect, and he could have filed divisionals.
Can you argue that the two-hole embodiment is really a colorable imitation of your four-hole embodiment when you didn't traverse the restriction requirement where the agency told you that the two-hole embodiment is patentably distinct from the four-hole embodiment? And thereby you need to elect and divide up your application into multiple applications.
I think we can because, again, I think the underlying issue is the patentability of the subject matter involved.
Well, the problem is that's not the way Festo describes it. At 736 of Festo, it says, estoppel arises when amendment is made to secure the patent and the amendment narrows the patent scope. So this is a situation having abided by the restriction requirement where the amendment was made to secure the patent. You're relying on our case in Merck, whereas the Supreme Court in Festo described it more broadly.
We still maintain that the issue goes to the underlying patentability of the subject matter involved.
But if we accept the FESTA language, this comes under that, right? This was something that was done to secure the patent.
Well, the FESTA decision also says that when the court is unable to determine the purpose underlying a narrowing amendment and hence a rationale for limiting the estoppel to the surrender of particular equivalents. So I think Festo is consistent with this court's decision in Merck, that the court is required to look at the underlying rationale and determine whether that surrender was made for reasons of patentability. And I don't think the court is requiring I don't think the court is referring to a procedural issue. I think the court is referring to patentability of the underlying subject matter. If it were simply a procedural issue, then an election is required in response to every restriction issued by an examiner, And in every instance, the underlying issue is patentability. And this
You could have gone on and prosecuted these other embodiments reflected in the drawings that were canceled in another application, right? There was nothing to prevent that from happening.
Absolutely, he could have. But if I could get back, the underlying issue in every instance would be a patentability issue, and the court's test in Merck would be meaningless. Yes, he could have filed five applications, and our position is simply that it would be unreasonable to require him to file five applications and or risk being stripped of the statutory scope of the patents that he did obtain.
Well, why is that unreasonable? I mean, you know, he canceled the claims. He didn't have to cancel the claims. He canceled them, and somebody looking at the prosecution history would say, well, I guess he's not pursuing those. I guess he's given them up.
I think someone looking at the file wrapper and having skill of one in the field, which is presumed to be someone familiar with patent law and procedure, would presume that the 070 patent was entitled to its colorable imitations. I mean, the rubric cited by defendants is simply what is disclosed but not claimed is surrendered. Well, it begs the question, what is claimed? And what is claimed here is what's issued in the 070. In addition, if I could, we don't feel that the district court properly performed an appropriate infringement analysis. It only looked at one of the six figures in the patent. It did not compare all six. There are not correlative figures for the so-called surrendered material for 2 through 6, and so there's an inadequate record in order to perform this doctrine of equivalence or this prosecution history estoppel non-infringement analysis. And finally, I don't think the court needs to address any of these issues because this is an issue that was never raised below in defendant's pleadings. Section 282 of the patent statute and Rule 8C of the federal rules require that, in the case of the patent statute, defenses of non-infringement shall be pleaded, and in the case of 8C, must be pleaded.
Okay. I think you've gone over your time here. Mr. Ruddy, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Snyder.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Darren Snyder. I represent the defendants Malibu Boats and Trustmark. I'm handling the argument on behalf of all of the defendants and appellees. The public notice function of patents is a bedrock principle of patent law. And an essential element of that principle is that an applicant cannot claim subject matter and then abandon it during prosecution and later try to reclaim it during an infringement action. That is precisely what the plaintiff, an appellant, is trying to do in this case. I'd like to make 3 points. First, the test for infringement of a design patent includes the notion of equivalence. Starting with Gorham versus White, and then in the original patent statute, and currently in Section 289, the statute refers to the patented design or a colorable imitation. Now, it turns out that in design patent cases, very rarely, if ever, do courts have to face the situation of an exact duplicate, the first part of that test, the patented design, because most often accused infringers don't use the exact design. Instead, they use some variation, which was the whole point of the substantial similarity or ordinary observer test that Gorham first articulated. Section 289 incorporates that notion by extending infringement to colorable imitations. But when this court has considered the scope of what does that colorable imitation mean, it is consistently recognized that equivalence, the same notion of doctrine of equivalence found in literal infringement, applies in the design patent context. That's found both in the Lee case and also in Minka Leiden. The second point I'd like to make, Your Honors, there is every good reason to apply the same principles of prosecution history estoppel to design patents as there are in utility patents. The same principles that govern the effect of what happens during prosecution should likewise limit the scope of the claim that is ultimately issued.
Well, let's pursue that for a moment. Let's suppose this were a utility patent, and the original claim had said 4 holes and 4 2-holes. And they had amended the claim to only claim the 4-hole embodiment. Would a three-hull embodiment have been surrendered by that amendment? That's something that troubles me a little bit. I mean, I agree that if they claimed anywhere between one and four hulls and narrowed it down to four hulls, that would be an amendment that would, where the area surrendered would include the three-hull embodiment. But this is a little different in the sense that they claimed four or two and they gave up two, and maybe it's not so easy to determine the scope of what was surrendered.
I think that's an essential and important question, Your Honor. So let me say a couple of things about it. First, it would be important to know in your hypothetical, why did the applicant make that amendment? Under FESTO, the presence of a narrowing amendment is only the first part of the test. You also have to then ask the second question. Was it to comply with some requirement of the Patent Act? Now, if the amendment in your hypothetical was done for no reason at all or had nothing to do with complying with the requirement of the Patent Act, then FESTO would not apply. If, on the other hand, it was to comply with a restriction requirement, if it was done to comply with
really
an order.
I think you're not really addressing my question. I'm asking the utility patent context. Let's assume that this amendment was made to overcome prior art, and the original claim was four or two, and they gave up two. Would three be within the scope of the estoppel?
Under FESTO, the court ruled that, or in FESTO, the court ruled that the applicant gives up all of the territory between the original application and the claim as it eventually issues. Now, if the original claim said two or four,
right,
I think that would be a very difficult case because the claimant is not claiming three in that instance. Here, however, you have a single claim where the applicant had a design that had no holes, two holes of varying shapes, and four holes. And then abandoned those designs in this application that had no holes or had two holes. And as the district court correctly found, you can look at them and easily see that a three-hole rectangular design is in the territory between a two-hole squared rectangular, two-hole design with rectangular holes and a design with four circular holes.
That's what the judge said?
The judge said that it falls within that territory, yes.
Well, yeah, I think what I saw the judge saying was that because prosecution history estoppel means you give up all the territory in between your original claim and your issued claim, therefore the three-hole embodiment is in between the two-hole embodiment and the four-hole embodiment. I didn't take the judge to say that the three-hole embodiment is so close to the two-hole embodiment that it's basically the two-hole embodiment that was given up and abandoned. Instead, she was saying to me, to answer Judge Dyke's hypothetical, it sounded like when the claim says four or two holes and you cancel two holes, she would say you've also given up three holes because that's the space in between the two-hole embodiment and the four-hole embodiment that was recited in that claim.
If I agree with your description of what the district court said. The district court looked at the original application that had the two-hole design, two rectangular holes. It looked at the accused design that has three rectangular holes, and it looked at the issued claim that has four circular holes. Now, keep in mind, and Judge Antone ruled that the three-hole design, three rectangular holes, falls in that territory between what was originally requested and what was ultimately issued. That's correct. And it might be difficult.
My problem is I'm not sure that's right in defining the territory that's surrendered, because you appear to agree that in a utility context, if you claim four or two, that three wouldn't necessarily be surrendered by amending the claim to eliminate two. That's the problem, it seems to me. Even accepting all the arguments that prosecution history estoppel ought to apply here and that the restriction these other embodiments to get the patent. I'm still trying to figure out how this case would come out if it were a utility patent claim.
So let me make two points, Your Honor.
And if I could just follow up, because I'm having the same concern. The concern I have is that, again, to use a utility patent analogy, it's as if you are reading the claim, as if the claim were to say anything 2 to 4 holds embodiments. That's what was the original claim. And then in the face of a prior art or restriction or something else, the applicant amended the claim down to a 4-hole embodiment. And then in that context, you would be right to say, oh, you gave up everything in between what was the 2 to 4. But now going back to Judge Dyke's hypothetical that I can't wait to hear your answer, the claim doesn't say 2 to 4. It says 2 or 4, and then 2 got canceled. So why did the 3-hole embodiment get also surrendered?
So let me make 2 points. First, there was prior art, the Ivy patent, with 3 rectangular holes before the patent office. We don't know whether that had anything to do with Mr. Bach's decision not to try and claim a 3-hole design. But had he tried to claim a 3-hole design, there was prior art that precluded that. Second, and I think this is – I'm trying very hard to –
That seems to be a different argument that, you know, this is barred under an obviousness theory or an anticipation theory or something like that, which is not – what the issue is before us.
And let me I want to try and answer your question. I think the difference inheres in the scope of a design patent versus a utility patent. In the context of a utility patent, in your hypothetical, you can have different elements, and each of those elements, using words, can specify them in different ways, 2 or 4. In the design patent context, the patent claims only a design. And the question is, what is the scope of that single design that is being claimed? Now, a patented design can allow for certain variations. And when this patent was originally applied for, it had designs with a hatch and no hatch. It had designs that had no holes in the corner post, 2 holes of either rectangular or oval shapes in the corner post. And it had designs with 4 holes in the corner post, some square, some circular. And the patent examiner found that that was at least 5 different patentably distinct designs. You could not have a design whose penumbra, if you will, or scope of colorable imitations could include all those variations, hatch or no hatch, different numbers, sizes, and shapes of holes. So the examiner required Mr. Bach to limit it to a single one of those 5 groups. Now, that would be different than the way that you would deal in the utility patent context. So I understand the hypothetical, but I think that the answer in this case lies in the difference between utility patents and the way that they are claimed and the design patent, where it has to be limited to a single patentable design. And what the examiner found was that that there were 5, and in response, Mr. Bach elected one that had 4 circular holes, and he abandoned and dedicated to the public all of the other designs other than the one that was subsequently pursued in a divisional application.
So I guess your argument is that the scope of the literal claim with respect to the 4-hole design was broad enough because of the colorable language to bring the 3-hole design within that.
Absolutely not. I don't believe that. I think if you look at the examiner's office, the restriction requirement, she assumed, we can infer fairly, that a difference in the number of holes was something that created a patentably distinct design. I would not concede that a 3-hole design that has different shapes, different sizes, different number of holes from the patented design would fall within the colorable limitations at all.
The same thing about the original 2-hole design, that wasn't broad enough to include the 3 holes?
I don't believe it would. That wasn't an issue that the district court had to address, but no, I don't believe that a design that has a different number of holes, different shapes of holes, different sizes of holes would fall within the scope of one of the designs as the examiner described them.
One thing I'm puzzled by in this situation is that my understanding of prosecution history estoppel, you typically have claim of broad scope, and then it gets cut back through an amendment, or maybe through argument. And so the scope of that claim has been reduced. Design patents feel a little different, I think, as you were just suggesting, in the sense that if you really have multiple different inventions in a design patent application, what you're not looking at a very, very broad drawing and then some smaller, more limited version of that drawing. You're looking at, in this particular instance, a bunch of standalone embodiments that aren't necessarily connected to each other. In fact, they're so unconnected to each other, we're assuming that they're patentably distinct. So, and then doctrine of equivalence, prosecution history estoppel, it's about surrendering the territory in between the claim you gave up and the claim that you kept. And I don't know how that works in a design patent context when you have patently distinct embodiments where you cancel one. Do you really give up any and all territory in between that patently distinct invention from the one that you actually patented? That seems to be the crux of your argument, and it's not clear to me how that works when I've never seen a prosecution history estoppel case work that way. They're typically some large circle and then a smaller concentric circle, and then the territory in between the two circles is what's been given up. I don't think we have that here.
I think first, FESTA requires and says that prosecution history estoppel applies to that territory between the abandoned claims and the claim that issued. That's the standard that we have to apply. Now, I understand, I believe your point is...
I'm not sure that's the right test. I would have thought that what it was saying is that it's to the extent that you've given up claim scope by the amendment, you can't reclaim it by the doctrine of equivalence. And so you have to find, I think, in order to apply prosecution history estoppel, that the original claim scope covered the equivalent, which is being asserted now.
So if we try and take your example, because we have a single design, all we have in front of us, as you point out, are the pictures, and we know that he tried to originally claim a corner post with no holes, some with two holes of varying shapes, some with four holes of varying shapes, some with hatches, some with no hatches. And the examiner correctly found that that has to be limited to a single design. Now, if you were going to translate that into words, I don't know if the applicant would have said a design that has zero, two, or four holes, or if the applicant would have said it's a design that has zero to four holes. We don't know how that would be done. Now, in the design patent context, it may in certain circumstances be extremely difficult to determine where the territory is between the original claim and the claim that issues. But in this context, it happens to be very easy because it's the difference in the number and the shape of the holes. He abandoned a design that had two rectangular holes, and he got a patent on a design that had four circular holes. And it doesn't take a lot to conclude that three rectangular holes is somewhere between two rectangular holes and four circular holes. Now, I agree with you that there may be circumstances where it is difficult to define the differences between an original design application because you're only working with those pictures. But this doesn't seem to be one of those. As Judge Antone recognized, when you line the pictures up, you can see that this one is in between that space. Three rectangular holes is between two rectangular holes and four circular holes. And it doesn't take a great leap to realize that.
Okay. Well, I think we're out of time. Thank you, Mr. Snyder.
Thank you.
Mr. Rowdy, you have 2 minutes there.
A couple of comments, Your Honor. I think the court has hit on the problem with the district court's opinion and defendant's position is if we take the language from FESTO literally, then all claim scope is between the two-hold embodiment and the four-hold embodiment. And the four-hold embodiment would be stripped of all colorable imitations. We are not seeking to reclaim through colorable imitations through the ordinary observer test what we surrendered in prosecution.
Do we have to, in order to apply prosecution history estoppel, do we have to find that the claimed equivalent was within the scope
see if I understand the question. In order to apply prosecution history estoppel, does the court have to conclude that the claimed equivalent
was within the scope of the original claim?
I think that's an issue for the jury.
Perhaps, but the question is, in instructing the jury or in making the decision, is that a requirement, that the claimed equivalent has to be within the scope of the original claim?
Scope meaning colorable imitations?
No, the literal scope of the original claim.
The surrendered scope, is that what the court's referring to? I'm having trouble understanding the question.
Well, it would be within the surrendered scope. It's part of the scope of the original claim that was surrendered.
Yes, I guess the court would have to conclude that, yes. And in this instance, I would submit that the scope's not within the scope of the surrendered material. There's not a sufficient record to make that determination. We are not attempting to recover through the ordinary observer test what we surrendered during prosecution. Presumably, the two-hole design would have a range of colorable imitations. The four-hole design would have a range of colorable imitations. They would overlap to a great degree. They're certainly not exclusive of each other. We are simply claiming that collectively, had Mr. Bach prosecuted a two-hole design, there would be collectively a broader range of colorable imitations. We're simply claiming that we're entitled to the colorable imitations of the four-hole design.
So if Malibu came out next month with a two-hole embodiment, you wouldn't file an amended complaint?
I'd have to think about it, Your Honor. I think we would still maintain that because it wasn't surrendered for reasons of patentability. But assuming that this court determined that it was, I don't think we would.
Are the holes in the hatch functional? Sorry to come out of left
field
here.
The holes in the corner post?
Yeah.
To some degree, they're functional, but that hasn't been argued in this case.
And the hatch is clearly functional.
The hatch is functional, yes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Rodney. The case is submitted.